Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. Sorry I started a little late tonight. I'm having difficulty with my switchboard here. I don't understand what's going on. Very strange. Anyway, I can't seem to get into my... don't know what they're doing here. Anyway, let me just check here. I'm trying to do something technically here that doesn't seem to be working. I don't know what's going on. I love it. Don't know. Anyway, something very, very weird is happening to me. This is, tonight I believe we're on. It looks like I'm on, but there's no way I can tell, based on my switchboard, right? And, so that's to be a problem here. It looks like I'm on, but, I'm expecting to be. Doesn't make any sense. Sorry, folks. Just wait one second here. I'm totally operating in the dark. Hey, God. They set up all these different things here. I have no idea what they're doing. They changed the format of the... And, screwed me up. Okay, here we go. So, we're on. Actually showed that I wasn't scheduled for tonight, and I couldn't understand why that was. Tonight I had planned to do a show around a book that I've read as excerpts from it before. I did one other show around it back quite a number of months ago. But the book is called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. It's from Eric Fromm. And many of you may know who Eric Fromm was, a very famous man of psychiatry. And Eric Fromm... let me just read a little bit about him so you know what we're talking about. He's the author of numerous best-selling books and has treated this haunting question, to the anatomy of human destructiveness. He's treated this question with the depth and scope of the most original and far-reaching work of his brilliant career. Fromm goes beyond the battle lines of controversy between instinctivists like Lorenz, who argue that man's destructiveness has been inherited from his animal ancestors, and behaviorists like Skinner, who maintain that there are no innate human traits since everything is a result of social conditioning. Conceding that there is a kind of aggression which man shares with animals, Fromm shows that it is defensive in nature, designed to ensure survival. And on the other hand, malignant aggression or destructiveness in which man kills without biological or social purpose is peculiarly human and not instinctive. It is part of the human character, one of the passions like love, ambition, and greed. That's fascinating. That to me is really a fascinating statement, because there is something in the human makeup that has always perplexed me, and I guess that's why this book has fascinated me. And what it is that in the human makeup, or at least from what we can see, all have an ability to defend ourselves, but some seem to be incapable of doing that. Especially, you know, of course, infants and so on are, but adults. And in my lifetime, I've seen so many incidences of that, where you have aggression and at the same time you have this remarkable passiveness or inability to seem to fight for yourself or fight to defend yourself. Thus we see things like bullying and whatnot, it's a very difficult thing, and of course this book is about 800 pages long. I take that back. It's actually about 500 or so pages, and it goes into great detail. But there, the destructive nature of man is so prevalent today. It's never. I can't remember a time in my own lifetime where this country has been in so many wars. Has been, you know, its people are so aggressive. On both sides of the on all sides of the political spectrum, left and right, and everyone is resorting to violence, to settle their scores, or even as a final statement, okay, in their lives, they blow away 10 or 20 or 30 people, it's very difficult to understand that psychosis of that, insanity. But you can see it so much in the atrocities that we hear about in war. In Abu Ghraib, for instance, and Guantanamo, and all of these places that are still operating, that are torturing people, holding them prisoner, and just, I don't know, or how we can callously send drones over villages in Pakistan or Afghanistan or something, just drop bombs indiscriminately, just spray an area with bombs and kill 100 people, innocent people, for some guy sitting in California, operating a game board, it's so removed today. I mean, it's difficult to understand, and I'm probably getting confusing you more. But there's some fascinating things in this book, and there's one segment that I wanted to read that was really quite remarkable. And they discuss, anthropology and, how we progressed as a hunter, how things changed. And I can't get into the whole thing, but there was a specific thing that I asked, several different examples of societies that I felt were important to mention. Like, for instance, System A. He has, several C and D. He has three or four examples of different societies, tribal societies, that create a remarkable view, if you will, of the different mindsets, cultural sets, cultural philosophies, all right, that that play into dealing with one another in a society. I just want to go into the see if I can find the first one here. Yeah, here we go. System A, life affirmative societies. In this system, the main emphasis of ideals, customs, and institutions is that they serve the preservation and growth of life in all of its forms. There is a minimum of hostility, violence, or cruelty among people, and no harsh punishment, hardly any crime. And the institutions of war, and the institution of war is absent, or plays an exceedingly small role. Children are treated with kindness, there is no severe corporal punishment, women are in general considered equal to men, or at least not exploited or humiliated, and there is a generally permissive and affirmative attitude toward sex. There is little envy, covetousness, greed, or exploitiveness. There is also little competition and individualism, and a great deal of cooperation. Personal property is only in things that are used. There is a great attitude of trust and confidence, not only in others, but particularly in nature, and a general prevalence of good humor and a relative absence of depressive moods. Among the societies falling under this life-affirming category, I have placed the Zuni Pueblo Indians, the Mountain Arapesh, and the Bathonga, the Aranda, the Semags, and the Todas, the Polar Eskimos, and the Mabutus. These are, of course, all primitive tribes. And one finds in the System A group both hunters, for instance, the Mabutus, and agriculturists, sheep owners, like the Zunis. And in it are societies with relatively abundant food supply and others characterized by a good deal of scarcity. This statement by no means implies, however, that the characterological differences are not dependent on and largely influenced by the differences of the socioeconomic structure of these respective societies. It only indicates that the obvious economic factors such as poverty or wealth, hunting or agriculture, etc., are not the only critical factors for the development of character. In order to understand the connection between economy and social character, one would have to study the total socioeconomic structure of each society. That's System A. Now, System B is called a non-destructive, aggressive society. The first one was a life-affirmative society. This one is non-destructive. This system shares with the first the basic element of not being destructive, but differs in that aggressiveness and war, although not central, are normal occurrences, and in that competition, hierarchy and individualism are present. These societies are by no means permeated by destructiveness or cruelty, or by exaggerated suspiciousness, but they do not have the kind of gentleness and trust which is characteristic of the System A societies. System B could perhaps be best characterized by stating that it is imbued with a spirit of male aggressiveness, individualism, the desire to get things and to accomplish tasks. And in my analysis, the following 14 tribes fall under this category: the Greenland Eskimos, the Bachizitas, the Ojibwas, the Infugawas, the Manus, the Samoans, the Dakotas, the Moras, Maoris, the Tasmanians, the Kazakhs, the Aniyus, and the Crows, the Incas, and the Hotots. I hope I pronounced some of those right, but in a system C, which are destructive societies, the structure of the system C societies are very distinct. It is characterized by such interpersonal violence, destructiveness, aggression, and cruelty, both within the tribe and against others. A pleasure in war, maliciousness, and treachery. Yeah, that sounds like the United States, doesn't it? And most of the Western societies. The whole atmosphere of life is one of hostility, tension, and fear. Usually there is a great deal of competition, great emphasis on private property, if not in material things, then in symbols. Strict hierarchies and a considerable amount of war making. Okay, examples for this system are the Dobus and the Quakiutl, the Hadeus and the Aztecs, the Witotos and the Ganda. I do not claim that my classification of each society under these categories is not open to controversy. But whether one agrees or disagrees with the classification of a few societies does not make too much difference. Because my main point is not statistical but qualitative. The main contrast lies between System A and B on one hand, which are both life-affirming, and System C, which is basically cruel or destructive, sadistic, or necrophilious, which is very fascinating. So an example of these systems, of the three systems, in order to help the reader to better to get a better picture of this nature of the three systems, I shall begin in the following a more detailed example of characteristic societies for each system. The Zuni Indians, System A. The Zuni Indians have been thoroughly studied by Ruth Benedict, 1934, as well as by Margaret Mead, Irving Goldman, Ruth Bunzel, and others. They live by agriculture and sheep herding in the western, in the southwestern United States. Like other Pueblo Indian societies, they inhabited numerous cities in the 12th and 13th centuries. But their history can be followed much further back to its simple beginnings in one-room stone houses, to each of which was attached an underground ceremonial chamber. Economically, they can be said to live in a state of abundance, although their apprehension for material goods is not very high. In their social attitude, there is very little competition, even though there is a limitation of irrigable land, irrigatable, should be, I guess, land. They are organized along metrocentric lines. Although priests and civil officials are men, individuals who are aggressive, competitive, and non-cooperative are regarded as, aberrant types. Work is done essentially in cooperation, with the exception of sheep raising, which is exclusively a man's occupation. In economic activities, rivalry is excluded, again with the exception of sheep raising, where one finds some squabbles, but no deep rivalries. On the whole, while little attention is paid to individual achievement, inasmuch as there is some quarreling, it is mainly caused by sexual jealousy and not in relation to economic activities or possessions. And that's fascinating, because it's so different than our own society, you know, and our own practices in the West. Hoarding is practically unknown. While there are richer and poorer individuals, wealth remains highly fluid, and it is characteristic of the Zuni attitude toward material goods that a man would lend his jewelry willingly, not only to friends, but to any member of the society who asks for it. In spite of a certain amount of sexual jealousy, marriages on the whole are lasting, although there is easy divorce. Women are, as one would expect in a matricentric society, in no way subordinate to men. There is a great deal of gift-giving, but in contrast to a number of competitive societies, this does not have the function of emphasizing one's own wealth or of humiliating the one to whom the gift is given, and no attempt is made to maintain reciprocity. Wealth does not remain long in one family, as it is acquired by individual work and industriousness, and exploitation of others is unknown. While there is private ownership of land, litigations are rare and quickly settled. And this is the way to go, man, as a society. This is the way to see it. The Zuni system can only be understood by the fact that material things are relatively little valued, and the fact that the major interest in life is religious. To put it another way, the dominant value is life and living itself, not things in their possession. Songs, prayers, rituals, and dances are the major and most important elements in the system. They are directed by priests who are highly respected, although they do not exercise any censures or jurisdiction. The value of religious life is against ownership, and economic success is seen in that officials who have the function of judges as cases of material litigation are not held in great respect, quite in contrast to the priests. The judges are not held in too high regard. Personal authority is perhaps the most rigorously disparaged trait among the Zuni. The definition of a good man is one who has a pleasing address, a yielding disposition, and a generous heart. Men never act violently and do not contemplate violence, even when the wife is unfaithful. And during the initiation period, boys are whipped and frightened by kakshinas. But in contrast to many other cultures, even this initiation is never in any way an ordeal. Murder hardly exists. As Benedict reports from her own observation, there is no memory of homicide. Suicide is outlawed, and themes of terror and danger are not cultivated in this myth or tales. Now see, we do all of that differently. Our society is very much like a sea society, and we'll talk about that. Let me bring up the Dobu tribe. There is no sense of sin, especially in connection with sex, and sexual chastity is generally regarded with disfavor. Sex is considered to be an incident in a happy life, but by no means, as in some other rather aggressive societies, the only source of pleasure. There seems to be some fear connected with sex, but insofar as there is fear, men are afraid of women and have sexual intercourse with them. Goldman mentions the prevalence of the theme of castration fear in a matriarchal society. This indicates man's fear of women rather than, as in Freud's concept, the fear of punishing father. In this picture of system characterized by unaggressiveness, nonviolence, cooperation, and enjoyment of life changed by the fact that one finds also jealousies and quarrels. No society could be characterized as nonviolent and peaceful if it has to live up to an absolute ideal of complete absence of hostility or any quarrels. But such a point of view is rather naive. Even basically unaggressive and nonviolent people will occasionally react with annoyance under certain conditions, especially those with a choleric temperament. This does not mean, however, that their character structure is aggressive, violent, or destructive. One might even go further and say that a culture where expressions of anger are as much tabooed as they are in the Sunni culture, sometimes a relatively mild quantity of anger will pile up and be expressed in a quarrel, but only if one is dogmatically attached to the view of man's innate aggression will one interpret these occasional quarrels as indicating the depth and intensity of the repressed aggression. So in other words, we're not really necessarily aggressive species, you know, to the sense that we are, it's just our natures, our individual nature. You know, some people are meaner than others or more crotchety than others. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the entire society is aggression or family or group or whatever it is, tribe. Such an interpretation is based on a misuse of Freudian discovery of unconscious motivation. The logic of this reasoning is, if a suspected trait is manifest, its existence is obvious and undeniable. But if it is completely absent, this very absence proves its presence. It must be repressed, and the less it shows manifestly, the more intense it must be in order to require such thorough repression. With this method, one can prove anything, and Freud's discovery is transformed into a means for empty dogmatism. Every psychoanalyst agrees in principle that the assumption that a certain drive is repressed requires that we have empirical evidence for the repression in dreams, fantasies, unintended behavior, and so on. However, this theoretical principle is often neglected in the analysis of persons and of cultures. One is so convinced of the validity of the premise required by the theory that a certain drive exists that one does not bother to discover its empirical manifestation. The analyst who proceeds this way acts in good faith because he is unaware of the fact that he expects to find what the theory claims, and nothing else. In the weighing of the anthropological evidence, care must be taken to avoid this error, without losing sight of the principle of psychoanalytical dialectics, that a trend can exist without being consciously perceived. In the case of the Zuni, there is no evidence that the absence of manifest hostility is due to an intense repression of aggression, and hence there is no valid reason to question the picture of an unaggressive, life-loving, cooperative system. Another method of ignoring the data offered by non-aggressive society is either to ignore them altogether or to maintain that they are of no importance. Thus Freud, for instance, is the famous in the famous letter to Einstein, dealt with the problem of peaceful primitive societies in the following way. We are told that in certain happy regions of the earth, where nature provides in abundance everything that man requires, there are races whose life is passed in tranquility and who know neither coercion nor aggression. I can scarcely believe it, and I could be glad to hear more of these fortunate beings. That was from Freud in 1933. And he says, I do not know what Freud's attitude would have been if he had known more about these fortunate beings. It seems he never made a serious attempt to inform himself about them. And I think it needs to comment that there's so much that we take for granted in the academic world, in the world of psychological world, or in the psychiatric world, philosophical world, you know, there are these theories or these lines of belief that are so tainted, so warped that they beggar the description, because they're like Freud, everything is sexual, you know, or, you know, it has some sexual root to it. You know, it's like, you know, that's pretty much been disproven, but I think that, you know, studying Jung's work, the collective consciousness of man is far more believable, and that and the archetypical influences the archetypes that play a significant role in man's societies and his dreams and his conscious and unconscious life is of course what manifests his reality. And I honestly believe that, because what we dream, what we envision, and what we create from our dream state eventually manifests in the state of reality. And of course, there are theories as to what's reality, what is reality, what is third dimensional reality, fourth dimensional, fifth dimensional reality, parallel universes. It's on and on. So there's really no set reality. For instance, we all have our own. We all create our own. But collectively, we somehow unify those values, concepts, beliefs into a collective form of understanding. And by doing so, we create religions and societies and civilizations and, means of communication and technology and so on. So that by us understanding and adapting to the same consciousness, if you will, or the same reality, entering the same reality, we communicate with one another and in these ways. However, our realities can be extremely different from somebody else's, like, for instance, System A to System C. Totally polar opposites in their entire ways of thinking. Where one is based on total trust and community, another is based on total distrust and so on. And malevolence, toward one another. But I guess what I'm starting to say is that as I try to evaluate these societies, and I look at my own society, we look at the United States, for instance, the American society, we are such a rigged up society. Oh my God. And unfortunately we're addicted to war. The war mentality in this country is in the aggression toward each other, in the competition toward each other, and it is reaching fevered pitches that to the point where we're seeing these massive killings, these massive these thefts, these bankers' bailouts, and the disregard for people's wealth and security, all turned into me and greed, and I'll take you, and I'm smarter than you, and I'm greater than you, and I'm greater than anybody. They have this Superman mentality, this Batman mentality. How do you talk somebody down from that extreme egotism? It's impossible as an individual to talk to a Bernie Madoff, in his prime. Right? It took many years and many people to bring him down and to capture him and to expose him for what he was. Or, you take these mass murderers like George W. Bush. am megalomaniac, you know, a sociopath, right? Who's responsible for the death of a million Iraqis, a million, not to mention Afghanis, and not to mention, the American lives that he just callously just allowed to be slaughtered, especially in the 9/11. Now, if anybody believes the official story, right? The official story is another deception and lie by the Bush administration, as well as by the Obama administration, as well as by everybody, you know, that's been involved with it in the last 10 years. So we're in the planning stages, and, you know, very few people realize that Osama bin Laden was actually a CIA operative. He was an agent, an asset. And it wasn't until they assassinated him. I mean, that was officially stated by foreign intelligence services brought about right before her death. Bhutto of Pakistan was assassinated within weeks after she announced in the David Frost interview that Osama bin Laden had been assassinated in 2007, and it had been verified to her by very high sources and intelligence sources and people who had actually done it. All right, that he had been assassinated. Yeah, I remember he had been supposedly floating around Pakistan and Afghanistan, so they knew that he was dead. But then the PSYOPs program was developed, and the deception was, you know, they had to keep the wars going, they had to keep a boogeyman, so they kept his, you know, ghost alive. And, you know, you don't hear anything about him anymore today, and you wonder why, and they hope that you never do. But these are this is the kind of society that we live in, which is extremely destructive and extremely wicked, okay? And God bless the people who are fighting this, and the brave journalists, the brave people that are the activists who are trying so hard to expose these criminals and these criminal actions, and are fighting and giving, you know, going to jails and, you know, going, you know, rioting, you know, to prove their point. And God bless them. I wish them, I support all of them. And, the truth is extremely valuable, and it's extremely rare in our society. And it's almost, I think Orwell said, in a time of deceit, revolution, truth is a revolutionary act, to speak the truth. And that's basically what we do here, try to speak the truth. So if you want to call us revolutionary, then I guess I am. I want to go back to this thing because I wanted to get into System B, okay, and his explanation of that, which is a life-affirming society. However, it's non-destructive, aggressive societies. And I'm just going to read that part. We have about 20 minutes left of the show. By the way, for those of you who might have just joined us, you can catch all of this in the archives after the show, but I'm reading from Eric Fromm, The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, and discussing the different, the three types of societies that he mentions, and as examples in primitive societies. And System 1, or System B, example here is Margaret Mead wrote about the Manus, the Manu tribe, and are an illustration for a system which is clearly distinguished from System A, meaning the life-affirming, non-aggressive society. Because this main aim of life is not living and enjoying enjoyment, art, and ritual, but the attainment of a personal success through economic activities. So this is interesting. So this is economic aggression society. On the other hand, the system of the manners is very different from the system C, of which the Dobus will be shown as an example. And the Manus are not essentially violent, destructive, or sadistic, nor are they malicious or treacherous. The Manus are sea-dwelling, fishing people living in villages built on piles in the lagoons along the south coast of the Great Admiralty Island. They trade their surplus catch with nearby agricultural land dwellers and obtain from them manufactured articles from more distant sections of the archipelago. All their energy is completely dedicated to material success, and they drive themselves so hard that many men die in their early middle age. In fact, it is rare for a man to live to see his first grandchild. That's kind of frightening, isn't it? How many people do you know like that in our society who are good people, but they are driven so hard to make money and to create wealth and economic success that they die in their 40s and 50s, you know? Yeah. This obsession for relentless work is upheld not only because of the fact that success is the main value, but because of the shame related to failure. Not to be able to pay back one's debt is a matter which leads to humiliation of the afflicted individual. Not to have any economic success, which promotes a certain amount of capital accumulation, puts one in the category of a man without any social prestige. But whatever social prestige a man has won by hard work is lost when he is no longer economically active. That's the same as us, isn't it? We're pretty much the same as we are. I mean, a man can be wealthy and happy and so on, but the minute he retires, you know, he's not, unless he's got millions of dollars. So the main emphasis in the training of the young is laid upon the respect for property, shame, and physical efficiency. Individualism is enhanced by the fact that the relatives compete with each other for the child's allegiance, and the child learns to consider itself valuable. Their marriage code is a strict one, resembling 19th century middle-class morality. The main vices are sex offenses, scandal-mongering, obscenity, failure to pay debts, failure to help relatives, and failure to keep one's house in repair. The training for, it is very much like we are here in this country, very puritanical ethic here. But the training for hard work and competition seems to be contradicted by one's phrase in the phase in the life of the young men before their marriage. The young unmarried men form a kind of community living in a common clubhouse, sharing a common mistress, usually a war prisoner, and their tobacco and betel nut. They live rather merry, roistering a life on the borders of society. Perhaps this interval is necessary to produce a modicum of pleasure and contentment during one's period of a male's life. But this idyllic life is interrupted for good by the act of marriage. In order to marry, the young man has to borrow money, and for the first few years of his marriage, there is only one goal for him, and that is to repay the debt incurred to his financial backer. He must not even enjoy his wife too much as long as he owes part of her to his sponsor. Man, that's pretty tough, isn't it? When this first obligation is met, those who want to avoid failure devote their life to amassing property themselves, which makes them backers of other marriages. And this is one condition for their becoming leaders in the community. They have to, imagine that? They're marriage financiers. It's kind of bizarre. But marriage itself is largely an economic affair in which personal affections and sexual interests play a small role. The relationship between man and wife remains as is not surprising under these circumstances, antagonistic, at least for approximately the first 15 years of marriage. Only when they begin to arrange their marriage for their children and their dependents does the relationship of couples assume a certain character of cooperation. Energy is so completely devoted to the overriding aim of success that personal motives of affection, loyalty, preference, dislike, and hatred are all barred. It is of crucial importance for the understanding of this system that while there is little love and affection, there is also little destructiveness or cruelty. Even within the fierce competition which dominates the whole picture, the interest is not to humiliate others, but only to maintain one's own position. Cruelty is relatively absent. In fact, those who do not succeed at all, who are failures, are left alone, not made the butt of aggression. War is not excluded, but in general it is disapproved of, except as a way of keeping young men out of mischief. While war serves sometimes for the capture of women to use as prostitutes, or on the whole it was considered disruptive of trade, it was not a way for success. Their ideal personality was not at all that of a hero, but of a highly competitive, successful, industrious, and non-passionate man. Their religious ideals clearly reflect this system. Their religion is not based on the attempt to attain ecstasy or oneness with nature, but it has purely practical purposes, placating ghosts with slight formal offerings, instituting methods of discovering causes of illness and fortune and remedy their causes. I only have 10 minutes left, and I wanted to get into the Dobu, which is most fascinating. I prefer to choose the Manus. There are a number of other societies in the B group which are less competitive and possessive than the Manu, but I prefer to choose the Manu because the example permits one to delineate more clearly the difference between an individualistic aggressive character structure and a cruel and sadistic character structure in System C. And I wanted to talk about System C, the Dobu. The inhabitants of the Dobu Islands are a good example for System C, and this was written by R. Benedict in 1934. While in close vicinity of the Trobriand Islands, so well known by the publications of Malinowski, their environment and character are entirely different. While the Trobians live in fertile land that provide easy and plentiful living, the Dobian Islands, on the other hand, are of volcanic nature and with small pockets of soil and poor fishing opportunities. The Dobians are not known among their neighbors for their poverty, however, but for their dangerousness. While they have no chiefs, they are a well-organized group arranged in concentric circles, within each of which specified traditional forms of hostility are allowed. Aside from the matrilineal grouping, the mother's milk, the susi, the mother's milk, where one finds a certain amount of cooperation and trust, the Dobians' interpersonal relations have the principle of distrusting everybody as a possible enemy. Even marriage does not lessen the hostility between the two families. A certain degree of peace is established by the fact that the couple live during the alternate years in the village of the husband and the village of the wife. The relations between husband and wife is full of suspiciousness and hostility. Faithfulness is not expected, and no Dobian will admit that a man and woman are ever together, even for the shortest period, except for sexual period purposes. In other words, they hate each other. Pretty bizarre. Two features are the main characteristics of this system: the importance of private ownership and a malignant sorcery. The exclusiveness of ownership among them is characterized by its fierceness and ruthlessness, for which Benedict gives many examples. Ownership of a garden and its privacy is respected to such degree that by custom man and wife have intercourse within it. Nobody must know the amount of property anyone has. It is as secret as if it had been stolen. And the same sense of ownership exists with regard to the ownership of incantations and charms. The Dogu have disease charms which produce and cure illnesses, and each illness has a special charm. An illness is explained exclusively as a result of malevolent use of charm. And some individuals own a charm which completely controls the production and cure of a certain illness. This disease and cure monopoly for one illness naturally gives them considerable power. And their whole life is governed by magic, since no result in any field is possible without it. And magical formula, quite aside from those connected with illness, are among the most important items of private property. So there's a lot of sorcery going on here, and a lot of mistrust. The most admired virtue, the greatest achievement, is wabu wabu, system of a sharp practice which stresses one's own gains at the expense of another's loss. The art is to reap personal advantage in a situation in which others are victims. This is a system quite different from that of the market, which in principle at least is based on fair exchange by which both sides are supposed to profit. Even more characteristic of the spirit in this system is their treachery. The ordinary relations, the Dobian, is suave and unctuously polite. As one man puts it, if we wish to kill a man, we approach him. We eat, drink, sleep, work, and rest with him, and it may be for several moons. We bide our time, we call him friend, and as a result, in a not infrequent case of murder, suspicion falls on those who have tried to be friends with the victim. Aside from material possession, the most passionate desires are in the field of sex. The problem of sex is complicated if we think of their general joylessness. Their conventions exclude laughter and make dourness a virtue. As one of them says, in the gardens we do not play, we do not sing, we do not yodel, we do not relate legends. In fact, Benedict reports of one man crouching on the outskirts of a village of another tribe where the people were dancing, and he indignantly repudiated the suggestion that he might join. My wife would say I had been happy. Happiness for them is paramount taboo. Nevertheless, this dourness and taboo on happiness or pleasurable activities goes together with promiscuity and with a high estimation of sexual passion and sexual techniques. In fact, the basic sexual teaching by which girls are prepared for marriage is that the way to hold their husband is to keep him sexually exhausted. It seems, in contrast, that the Zuni sexual satisfaction is almost the only pleasureful and exhilarating experience the Dobians permit themselves. Nevertheless, as we would expect, their sexual life is colored by their character structure, and it would seem that their sexual satisfaction carries with it only a modicum of joy and in no way a basis for warm and friendly relations between man and woman. Paradoxically, they are very prudish, and in this respect, as Benedict mentions, as extreme as the Puritans. It seems that precisely because happiness and enjoyment are tabooed, sex must assume the quality of something bad, though very desirable. Indeed, sexual passion can serve as a compensation for joylessness, just as much as it can be an expression of joy. With the Dobians, it clearly seems to be the former. Amazing, huh? And, goes on a little. I can't emphasize enough if you can possibly pick up a copy of this book. It should still be in print somewhere, in paperback somewhere or something. But The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness by Eric Fromm, Fromm. And I think his copyright date was 1990-something. Hang on a second, I will try to find it. Copyright page. Let's see. 1973 is when this was written. So, You might want to get a, if you can find a copy of it, I suggest it should be out there. Then this is a classic text of anthropological and sociological and psychological discovery. Amazing. But anyway, we're just about to end the show. It's at 9 o'clock. It's about 2 minutes left. Let me just end with this statement. Life in Dobu fosters extreme forms of animosity and malignancy, which most societies have minimized by their institutions. Dobian institutions, on the other hand, exalt them to the highest degree. Dobian lives outside the repression man's worst nightmares of ill will of the universe, and according to his view of life, virtue consists in select victim upon which the malignancy is attributed. So in other words, they're into sorcery. But beforehand, we'll probably end on this word, and that's our society is very much like all of them. You know, it has elements of all three, and but primarily there are pockets to this world of this country that seem to be exceedingly System C, you know, and definitely System B. We can see the economic enslavement of our society in people striving for the dollar and dying, you know, at young ages of heart conditions and stress. And, you know, unfortunately, they also die impoverished because the system that we're in, you know, oftentimes doesn't reward the hard work of people and, you know, lay them off. But I want to thank everybody for joining me, and we're done. The live stream is done, but again, I wanted to mention that I wanted to thank you for joining me, and I hope you're interested. And